Muses of Sicily, let me sing a little more grandly. Orchards and humble tamarisks don't please everyone. If I sing of the woods, let the woods be fit for a consul. Now the last age of the Cumaean prophecy begins. The great roll call of the centuries is born anew. Now virgin justice returns, and Saturn's reign. Now a new race descends from the heavens above. Only favor the child who's born, pure Lucina, under whom the first race of iron shall end, and a golden race rise up throughout the world. Now your Apollo reigns. For Pollio, in your consulship, this noble age begins. At first glance, some of the writings of the ancient Roman Virgil seem strangely modern with its celebration of the outdoors and its talk of a golden age and a golden race. Who was the man known as one of Rome's greatest poets? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did Virgil fare during those turbulent years that brought the assassination of Julius Caesar? What was his purpose in writing his great epic, the Aeneid? And why did his reputation flourish during the Renaissance? Our guest is Grant Nelson-Stewart, professor in the Department of Classics at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Twain said that a classic is something that everybody wants to have read and nobody wants to read. And I think sometimes Virgil's Aeneid might fit that category as a work that we've all heard of as this great masterpiece, but many of us have not read or have not read lately. Can you say something before we get more into Virgil's life and times and so on, just about maybe what we would miss if we never read the Aeneid from your point of view?
That's a great question. I'm disposed to answer this simply by saying that, it's the greatest Latin work by the greatest Roman poet. But that is not, that doesn't obviously answer your question. To have not read the Aeneid really entails missing out on reading a work that really asks us to consider the cost of history and to reevaluate difficult times in the formation of a state, times that seem to have been a necessity in hindsight, retrospectively. But the Aeneid really asks us to consider whether or not the events had to happen the way that they did happen. And so I think it allows us, it asks us to, in turn, look at our own history and reevaluate that as well.
So. And how is it as poetry?
Well, it depends on the translation, right?
So, if you know a little Latin, how is the Latin, for that matter?
Yeah. No, in terms of a piece of poetry, it's superb. The ancient Romans recognized Virgil as the greatest poet, and that's just unanimous throughout the Latin tradition. Nobody really can challenge him in that respect. Technically, he advances meter and epic poetry far beyond what had been done up to that point. And, the passages can range from grandiloquent, descriptions of places and events and of battles to quite tender moments of emotion, romance, sadness, grief, sorrow. So I think you get a full representation of the human experience in the work.
And the human experience, particularly as lived in the first century B.C.
Definitely, yes.
Well, tell us about Virgil the man. I know when we talked some time ago about Homer with one of your colleagues in classics, we had to sort of sort through myth and fact about Homer.
Right.
And in the case of Virgil, what do we know for sure? And then what's sort of just anecdotal?
Sure. So there is no comparable Virgilian question, by which I mean that in the study of Homer, there's a question as to whether or not there was a historical Homer, right? In the case of Virgil, we know that there was a historical Virgil. And it seems to be the case that he was born in 70 BC and that he lived until 19 BC. And we don't have any real strong evidence to suggest that those dates are somehow wrong or incorrect or are fabricated at a later date. They come from a biographical tradition that, we have to accept from that's found primarily in the ancient scholarly tradition, so ancient commentaries on the poem itself. So he's born in 70 in Mantua, which is in northern Italy. He goes to school. So he's born to a well-to-do family. They seem to have owned land. and by some accounts quite extensive pieces of land in the region. So you can think of him as coming from kind of a locally prominent family, but one that doesn't have any particular standing in Rome per se, right? So we're told that his father sent him off to Naples and Rome to be educated, where he probably received the standard education that most Roman aristocratic youth would have received at the time, which included like extensive training in rhetoric primarily and the study of Greek. Yeah, so that's kind of a his background.
And what would he have – I mean, how did he – pay the equivalent of the rent? I mean, how did he make a living?
His family was well-to-do, right? Mm-hmm. So in his earlier years, he would have lived off of the money that his familial estate provided him with. Later on, when we can start to call him kind of like a professional poet, he had a couple of patrons, most prominently this man named Maecenas. It seems to be the case that he may have had a patron before that, this Gaius Asinius Pollio, who's mentioned in Eclogue 4 that you just read, Norman. But by 38-37 BC, he is connected with this literary group that's associated with Maecenas. And Maecenas, you can kind of think of him as a minister of culture. He, in turn, is connected with Octavian at this point. Octavian is one of the two major leaders, in a sense, in the 30s. The history is quite problematic at this time. That is, it's a period riven that's characterized by a civil war in particular. But Maecenas is associated with Octavian, and Maecenas would have provided Virgil, did provide Virgil, as well as a couple of other famous poets, Horace in particular, with the means to live comfortably and to compose poetry as a profession.
What sort of topics does Virgil take on initially? Do these Roman poets in general write about current events at all, or does it really fall into the more timeless realm of gods and goddesses and heroes?
Yeah. It depends on the author and it depends on the genre in which the author writes. Virgil, in particular, I guess his works aren't directly related necessarily to particular historical events that are happening. The Eclogue that you read, in fact, is in some respects the least characteristic of the Eclogues.
Now, really?
You could say this about every one of the Eclogues. There, despite a fair amount of continuity between them, there's a whole lot of variety as well. So it depends on the author and the work. So, for example, Horace writes a series of poems that are referred to collectively as the satires, and those we'll talk about specific historical events directly or indirectly. So that those poems are more easy to pin down in their particular historical context. Virgil, on the other hand, the Eclogues and the Aeneid, there are various allusions to contemporary historical events, but for the most part, they avoid direct reference to those particular events. The Georgics, the other main work of Virgil, which is a didactic poem on farming, is kind of a more of a mixed bag in that the Georgics just entails its own host of problems with studying.
We'll get into that too, and of course we'll get into the Aeneid also. But if Virgil is writing then about the grander things, again, the world of the gods and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. what kind of freshness does he bring to it? Mm-hmm. Because this is ground that's been plowed for centuries by now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's where Virgil the poet really should be invoked, just in terms of the way that he reworks the meter in which epic is written. Dactylic Hexameter is one of the ways in which he kind of brings fresh life to this epic tradition.
Had that not been used before?
It had been used for a long time, but he refines it. Basically, Virgil draws upon the Homeric tradition of epic, and then he also draws upon more recent, more contemporary developments in poetry, the so-called neoterics, who you can kind of think of them as, I guess, almost like a group of hipster, to use a modern analogy, poets who eschew traditional epic vocabulary. So the use of these high-sounding, archaic words. Instead, they tend to prefer the more conventional, almost more colloquial word at times. Mm-hmm. And so Virgil will bring that sensibility into his poetry, but at the same time, right within the Homeric tradition.
I'm wondering if you could give us a sample passage in Latin from Virgil and then maybe talk about just what makes it Virgil, what for you kind of characterizes his voice as a poet.
Especially if you have some dactylic hexameter because, yeah. Let's see, the only line of that I can think of is actually, isn't at the beginning, isn't Hiawatha in dactylic hexameter? This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines.
So it's six beats with a strong emphasis on the first syllable.
Yeah.
But let's hear, if we could hear some in Latin,
sure.
The way Virgil's contemporaries would have heard it.
Sure. So I think what I should do is I should follow the customary practice and just read something from the beginning. So as you said, it is six beats. Each foot is characterized by either a long followed by two short beats or two long beats within each foot and then 6 feet overall. So armo virum que cano troiae qui prima saboris italiam fato profugus lavinia que venit litera multilet teris iactatus et alto vi superem. Sai vae memorem unonis ab iram, multaquoquet bello passus dum conderet urbem, and so on.
Of was, arms and the man I sing?
Yes. So famously, the Aeneid opens with that, those three words. So.
Now, a big difference between Homer and Virgil, other than several hundred years, is oral versus a written tradition.
Mm-hmm.
By now we have a pretty long written tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a sense that Virgil wrote for the ear, though? Well, in other words, he wrote it down. He wrote it to be read as text, but did he write it with a sense that it was going to be read aloud?
Yes. We do know that he wrote all of his poetry with a view to it being performed, and we get anecdotes of that in other ancient authors. So, for example, there's a portion in Book 6 of the Aeneid where he refers to a Roman named Marcellus who recently died and who's connected with the family of Octavian, who at this point is Augustus, but that's another story. And we're told that Livia, in particular, one of the audience members, faints when she hears this person invoked. We know that, for example, the eclogues, which is this bucolic poetry, basically songs sung between shepherds, was performed on the stage and was quite well received. But this is a challenge in terms of studying it today from a modern standpoint. I tend to read it as simply a piece of written literature, right? And so I often—
Not as performance.
Not as performance. And there are some people who try to do – to reconstruct kind of the performative context. But in the end, you have to – it involves a great amount of speculation, frankly.
Do we know that whether or not it would have been accompanied by music, for example?
I believe that some people suggest that the eclogues were accompanied by music, but I've never heard that argument made for the Georgics and the
Aeneid.
And the Aeneid, I don't think.
And does the Aeneid have things like alliteration and, you know, things that suggest that Virgil was playing with language?
Sure, yeah. It definitely does. So there is a fair amount of alliteration. One of the things that he does and is he develops the so-called caesura, which is the natural sense break in a line. And so he has a very rigorous observance of different types of caesura. So that all speaks, I think, to the fact that he is, when he's composing this poetry, doing it with a view to it being heard.
And would it be fair to say that in some ways Virgil was creating a kind of Roman propaganda? In other words, is this a sort of, you know, I can outdo Homer and I'm going to tell the story of Rome? Is it a deliberate sort of, in a way, boosterism of Rome?
That's a great question. And in fact, that question has been at the heart of much scholarship surrounding the Aeneid in particular, but also the Georgics for the last 30, 40, 50 years. In particular, at least in the English-speaking world, scholars in the backdrop of the Vietnam War and its aftermath there's been a strong strand of criticism that rejects that view of the Aeneid as simply being this piece of propaganda that extols the greatness of Rome and extols the greatness of Aeneas. And instead, while sometimes explicitly doing that or nominally doing that, in fact, subverts that message in certain ways by showing a dark underbelly to both Aeneas and the history of Rome.
How are the books, the eclogues, Georgics, the Aeneid, how are they disseminated? I mean, multiple copies published in effect and circulated through the empire?
Well, initially, these pieces of poetry would have been circulated amongst small coteries of poets and patrons, right? So copying a manuscript would involve a lot of time and effort and labor, money. You'd have to have the slaves,
often too,
right?
Yeah.
Slaves would be the ones who would probably do it. So that's where like a patron comes into play, Maecenas and Pollio, but primarily Maecenas. So having a patron not only gives you your own livelihood, but kind of opens up your provides you with an audience in a sense. Now, Virgil quickly establishes a reputation where that transcends his particular group of poets and his patron. But a lot of this just would have been circulated amongst the elite. And then, you know, the so-called common people would be able to catch snippets of it in various public performances, of course.
And was there censorship? In other words, if Virgil had wanted to criticize something very directly, would the Aeneid, for example, have gone through some kind of review process and faced censorship before it was disseminated? Or could he have said whatever he wanted to?
There was no formal process of censorship, of course. But for Virgil to be critical of, say, the prevailing regime would probably offend his patron, Maecenas, and would probably offend the good friend of Maecenas, Octavian, who's later known as Augustus. So in that respect there, yeah, you could maybe say that the fact that he is connected with these politically important, influential people and that his own literary career kind of depends on his relationship, in effect, provides constraints on what he may say.
Self-censorship.
Self-censorship.
Assuming he had some discontentment in the first place.
Right.
So he would have to do what Emily Dickinson said when she said, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. In other words, well, get it in there, but indirectly.
Yeah. Writers have been doing that for centuries. Before we look at the Aeneid, give us some kind of a sketch of Rome in those first years B.C., the first century B.C., in terms of what the cultural life was like and what the political life was like. Was this really the high water mark of Roman civilization?
In some respects, yes. It was also, in other respects, the low point, I think. So, culturally, what you see in the first century BC is this. You see a Rome, and I'm going to talk – when I talk about Rome here, I'm talking about Rome, the Rome of the elites, okay? So unfortunately, classics and the study of classical literature is largely the study of the elite. And there are people who study, you know, like non-elite culture in particular. And you can do that through literature as well, but I'm going to talk about the elite culture for the moment. So what you see in the first century BC is Rome grappling with the – from some perspectives, intrusion, from other perspectives, the welcome influx of Greek learning and Greek knowledge in particular. The Romans tended to pride themselves. So let me give you an anecdote. About 150, mid-second century BC, you have a guy named Cato the Elder who in particular famously claims that Greeks as a race are out to kill Romans and shouldn't be trusted and so on. And he doesn't say it so eloquently, but I mean so directly rather, but he suggests that Greek learning presents a threat to Roman morals in general. By the first century BC, all Roman aristocratic youth are being trained in Greek in addition to some instruction in Latin. They're learning in particular Greek rhetoric. And so for Romans of the century, this kind of presents a problem because of the moral relativity that may be inherent in learning rhetoric and how to argue both sides, one side against the other side. So according to some Romans, for example, Sallust, who's a historian, you see traditional Roman morals being eroded, and that leads then to this debased form of Roman culture which when coupled with the rise of some great individuals leads then to a period of civil war. So you have the kind of the cultural stuff going on the one hand. Politically, what you have is you have a series of civil wars over the course of the first century BC, beginning in 88 through 80. This is the first time that Romans and Italians fight each other on a massive scale for extended periods of time.
And is this just a matter of power grab efforts, or is there some kind of ideological difference?
A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. One thing – so if you read a textbook of Roman history, this period is often described as the rise of great generals, the period of great generals. So guys like Sulla, Marius, Pompey the Great, Julius Caesar, men who held prominent political positions for many, many years. There's kind of an unwritten rule before this that if you hold a position of consul, which is kind of like being president, you only do it once. Men who have huge numbers of troops who serve for them for a long time and are personally indebted to them because they no longer have family farms, either because they've lost them while they've been serving or because they were poor to begin with. And so in a sense, their allegiance lies more with their commander and not the Roman state. And so you have the rise of these great individuals and they come into conflict with one another, sometimes for very personal reasons, sometimes more ideological. So
we're going to look at conflict as it plays out in the Aeneid when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Arms I sing, and a man, the first to come from the shores of Troy, exiled by fate, to Italy and the Lavinian coast, a man battered on land and sea by the powers above, in the face of Juno's relentless wrath, a man who also suffered greatly in war until he could found his city and bring his gods into Latium, from which arose the Latin people, our Alban forefathers, and the high walls of everlasting Rome. Muse, tell me why the Queen of Heaven was so aggrieved, her godhead so offended, that she forced a man of faultless devotion to endure so much hardship. Can there be anger so great in the hearts of gods on high?
So begins that very same work that if you were with us from the beginning, you heard in Latin, that is to say, Virgil's Aeneid. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Grant Nelson-Stewart, and we're looking at the work of the great Roman poet of the first century BC, Virgil. Well, I heard the wrath word in there, which, you know, is also very reminiscent of the beginning of the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're assuming from the beginning, I think, that in writing the Aeneid about Aeneas, that Virgil is very deliberately connecting to the tradition of Homer.
He is. He is. And so, yeah, you're right to pick up on that word. That word actually ends the passage, whereas in the Iliad, rage, manen, is the first word. There, I read the preface, and the Latin equivalent, ira, is in fact the last word. So there might be an example where Virgil is clearly taking something from Homer and, in that case, inverting it. So if Homer begins with it, let me end with it, right?
Uh-huh.
And there's some other things going on there. So the rage of Achilles is one of the main themes of the Iliad. Here, it's can there be anger in such rage amongst the gods?
Right.
So this isn't a mortal form of anger. Instead, it's an immortal one, right? A divine one. And in particular, we'll go on to find out that it's Juno who has a grudge against the Trojans and Aeneas in particular.
And is fate going to play as big a role in Virgil as it does in Homer?
Yes, it plays as much of a role as it does in Homer. We're told throughout the epic that Aeneas is a man fated to found Rome and that the various events that happen unfold according to fate.
At least that's a positive fate, unlike, you know, some of the, in the Grecian sense, we tend to think of fate as being, you know, if you're Oedipus, you are fated to go through this bad track and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
And we see some of that in Homer too, I think. But here, you are fated to found Rome, you could do a lot worse.
It's true. On the other hand, he's also fated to suffer greatly and to basically lose everybody he cares about, with the exception of his own son, in the course of founding the city. So I think that's a good example of how we're left to wonder, you know, was it worth it to found the city?
It always seems in both the Greek and Roman epics that the gods are intriguing because they're so human-like in their ability to feel envy and to, you know, just act in ways that are not godlike. Can you give us the basic plot here, including the wrath of Juno and her reasons for stirring everything up this way?
Sure. So the Aeneid takes place after the events of the Iliad, which means that the city of Troy has been sacked, and Aeneas is one of the few survivors from that event. So he's a Trojan. The Greeks have won. Aeneas must leave Troy and must travel to Italy, as is decreed by fate, and found a new city, a city that will one day, as is also fated, will rule all of the world, or what the Romans knew of the world at the time, which is basically the Mediterranean. They knew of other places, but, you know, they say the entire world, they mean what they control.
The important part.
Right.
So he's a surviving Trojan soldier.
Yeah. So he's basically a refugee leading other Trojan refugees across the Mediterranean to Italy. So the first six books correspond, well, detailed Aeneas's travel from Troy to Italy. In that respect, they resemble that work by Homer, namely the Odyssey, right? The second set of books, 7 through 12, talk about Aeneas's the battles, the war that he must fight once he arrives in Italy with local Italians before he can found his city. In that respect, because it's, again, about war, that's the Iliadic portion of the Aeneid.
Now, how does Aeneas founding Rome square with Romulus and Remus? I thought they were the ones who founded Rome.
It's true. So technically speaking, okay, Aeneas founds the precursor to the precursor of Rome.
Ah.
Okay? He ends up founding a city called Lavinium. His son then founds the city Alba Longa, which is mentioned in the preface. And then it's the lineage of kings from whom Romulus and Remus issue, some 400 years after the fact. So all this is rough dates, and of course it's mythology and so on. But ancient historians tried to assign certain dates, so we just kind of generally follow it.
And what kind of character does Aeneas have? You know, what flaws does he have? What quirks? What noble virtues?
Yeah. So Aeneas is most famously pious. He's the man of piety. And the word in Latin is pietas. And that's basically a value that entails duty to one's gods, state, and family in that order. So the gods come first. The state depends on that successful relationship with the gods. And then in turn, the family is subordinate to the state in a sense. So he's the man of pietas. That's what he's explicitly said to be. What the epic ends up doing throughout a number of points is kind of problematizing that and calling into question and showing competing claims to this pietas at times, or at times showing moments where Aeneas, in fact, may flout this greater virtue that he claims that he's associated with, and instead acts out of his own personal interest or out of his own emotional outbursts.
So he's a Trojan outcast or refugee, mm-hmm. as you say, at the end of the war. Why is he making his way toward Rome? Is that just kind of a blind quest on his part that happens to be fated, or what makes him choose to go there?
It is revealed to him by various characters in the first six books and by various events that he is to go to Italy to found this city. So all this culminates, for example, in his journey down into the underworld in book six, where it's revealed by his father, who passes away in the course of the epic, that he is to make it to Latium in particular to found a city that will one day rule the world. Initially, he just sets out because they can't stay in Asia Minor, right?
Now, is Aeneas alone, or has he got a company with him?
He has a company with him. I believe he has 9 other ships commanded by other Trojan leaders, figures who do show up in the Iliad but are very minor.
So. Does he face temptations the way Odysseus kind of gets distracted by various temptresses, or has his men turn into pigs, or, you know, whatever?
Yeah.
All kinds of crazy things happen for Odysseus in his 10-year wanderings.
Yes, definitely. I guess the amount of fabulous, the fabulous aspect doesn't apply so much to the Aeneid. So instead of meeting up with a goddess and spending some 7 years or however long it is on an island with her pining for his wife, Aeneas instead, for example, happens upon Queen Dido, who is the queen of Carthage, and strikes up some kind of relationship with her. The nature of that particular relationship is open to question. Dido herself would prefer to see it as a marriage. Aeneas himself may have seen it that way at one point, but later on would claim that it is not.
It is a very, very old story indeed.
And does she commit suicide then? Is that
she does. She does. Yeah. So I should just make a plug for book 4 of the Aeneid. If you can only read one book of the Aeneid, you should read book 4. It's in a sense kind of it's a self-contained narrative of the story between of the relationship between Dido and Aeneas. And what starts off as an intense relationship leads eventually to Aeneas resuming his mission, given by God and fate to found the city of Rome. But which also issues in Dido's own suicide.
No, historically there was conflict between Rome and Carthage. And how does this relationship between Dido and Aeneas relate to that?
In Dido's death speech, so shortly before she kills herself, she curses Aeneas and all of his descendants. And in particular, she basically prays for avenger of her to come forth. And in the text, it's made clear through some verbal play, but also just contextually, that this refers to Hannibal, the famous the famous Carthaginian general,
right,
who led, famously elephants over the Alps into Italy. So in that respect, the story of Aeneas and Dido, which seems to be one of the most signature contributions of Virgil to the stories, to the mythology surrounding Aeneas, provides an etiology, that is an account of the beginning of the historical hostility mm-hmm. between Carthage and Rome.
Which ended with a Roman victory and the obliteration of Carthage.
Yes.
And what about Aeneas's relationship to his wife and her death?
Book 1 opens up with Aeneas as a refugee. Books 2 and 3 are flashbacks then, and we're Aeneas is the narrator, and he tells us what happened. So book 2 tells us the story of the sack of Troy. And as he's escaping the city, he's carrying his father, Anchises, on his shoulder, and he has his son Iulus or Ascanius by hand. And so that's kind of an iconic image of Aeneas, the man of pietas. He's saving his father, he who comes before him, and he's also saving his son, the future of his own family lineage as well as Rome. And he tells his wife Crusa to follow behind. And in the course of escaping from the city, he loses her. And then he doesn't realize this until they make it to the shores. And then he goes back in the city, and the city is being sacked, and the city's being sacked, a terrible scene going on. And at that point, he's crying out for Crusa, and she comes to him in the form of a ghost and explains what happened, that, she was killed. And so she says that he has to go on and make his way to Italy, and he'll find a new bride eventually. Now, this is an interesting moment. So on the one hand, you have Aeneas in his most iconic moments, protecting his father and his son, saving them. But his wife, he loses her. And it turns out that being a woman romantically involved with Aeneas is really not a good thing.
It's not sounding too good so far between Dido and
no.
the wife.
Crusa, Dido, his wife, and then his future bride. Her mother ends up hanging herself, and a battle results from that, where huge amounts of lives on both sides are lost.
Significance of Aeneas being a Trojan versus a Greek. So, we've already set up this conflict between the Carthaginians and the Romans, mm-hmm. and the fact that Rome has been in some kind of conflict with Greece, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just another way of saying, well, we're the others. We're not Greeks. We're not Carthaginians.
It is. It's hard to say exactly when the Aeneas story was associated with Rome, though we have some archaeological evidence that dates to the 6th century BC, some 500 years before Virgil wrote. There's a particular moment that I always kind of point to when explaining this to students, and that is in the 3rd century BC, Rome gets involved in its first inter-Mediterranean conflict. A man named Pyrrhus, he's a warlord from Epirus, comes over, fights on the side of some Greek city-states in Italy. The southern portion of Italy is ethnically Greek. And he presents this conflict that he engages in with the Romans as a new Trojan War. So he – and he traces his own lineage back to Neoptolemus, who's the son of Achilles. So you have the descendants of the Trojan War fighting each other again. Now, Rome eventually wins that conflict, right? But I think that's an instructive incident where we can see Rome being acknowledged as, in some sense, Trojan. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it may also – maybe not that so much that incident, but it kind of by the Romans laying claim to this Trojan lineage, they are within the Greek mythological tradition, but they're still distinct from it, as you said.
And so, does he pick up on the Trojan horse aspect of the story?
Yes, definitely. And that shows up in book two of the Aeneid. And in fact, that's probably the most famous account that we have from the ancient world. The Trojan horse, of course, is the stratagem that the Greeks use to sack the city of Troy. They are unable to defeat Troy in open pitch battle. So Odysseus, in conjunction with another guy, sometimes traditions vary as to who gets exact credit for it, but basically comes up with this plan to create a horse in which all of the many Greeks will hide, and then this horse is being represented as a votive offering. It's brought into the city, unbeknownst to the Trojans. It leads then to the Greeks coming out at night and sacking the city and the end of Troy. So,
which is why it is a good idea, after all, to look a gift horse in the mouth.
It is.
And so, what are the vicissitudes other than personal in terms of Aeneas founding Rome? I mean, again, if we're going to compare it with or contrast it with the Homeric tradition of this war, which has to be won, you know, through trickery ultimately, what is the parallel, if any, between that and Aeneas, you know, going to Rome? Who does he have to prevail over in order to fulfill his fate?
Yeah. So once he makes his way to Italy, he meets up with a king named Latinus. And it's at that point that Latinus, who is aware of he's received his own prophecy that basically he's supposed to marry his daughter to a foreigner. So this king betroths his daughter, Lavinia, to Aeneas. Turns out that the local prince, Turnus, of the Rutulians, who is a local Italian community, he's in love with this woman, and one thing leads to another, and there are some other things that go on. But basically, they end up fighting over the hand of Lavinia. So what ends up happening then is that you have Trojans who have just recently arrived in Italy fighting Rutulians and Latins. And at the same time, they have some of those Latins on their own side. And then, of course, the Trojans themselves will one day be Romans.
Right.
So what you have then is you have kind of a proto-civil war happening. And that, of course, resonates greatly with Virgil's own time, in which you have a series of basically 30 years worth of civil wars going on as a historical fact.
We'll look at the conclusion of the Aeneid, if indeed there is one. And we'll look at the other works and the legacy of Virgil right after this, when we return to University of the Air.
Aeneas stood there, lethal in his bronze. His eyes searched the distance, and his hand paused on the hilt of his sword. Turnus's words were winning him over, but then his gaze shifted to the fateful baldric on his enemy's shoulder, and the belt glittered with its familiar metalwork, the belt of young Pallas, whom Turnus had killed and whose insignia he now wore as a trophy. Aeneas's eyes drank in this memorial of his own savage grief, and then, burning with fury and terrible in his wrath, he said, "Do you think you can get away from me while wearing the spoils of one of my men? Pallas sacrifices you with this stroke, Pallas, and makes you pay with your guilty blood." Saying this and seething with rage, Aeneas buried his sword in Turnus's chest. The man's limbs went limp and cold, and with a moan, his soul fled resentfully down to the shades.
That's the conclusion to Virgil's Aeneid, the ancient Roman epic. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Grant Nelson-Stewen. We're talking about Virgil. Is it true that Virgil died before he really finished this great 12-book epic?
It is true. He dies in 19 BC, and we have concrete evidence of that in the text itself, some 50, 60 lines that are incomplete, about only half done.
This ending, what is happening? I mean, we again have that word wrath.
Right.
It's not an upbeat ending here. Tell us about it.
No, it isn't. And some people have seen the fact that it ends simply with Aeneas in almost cold-blooded fashion killing his main opponent, Turnus, as Turnus is already incapacitated, as evidence that that Virgil was going to add more books, perhaps another 12 or something to it. That view has long since been discredited, I think. There are a few people who still hold it. My respect to them. But so the end itself, we shouldn't see the end as necessarily incomplete, I don't think. I think the end, though, leaves us with a powerfully ambivalent view of Aeneas. So we have Aeneas standing over his conquered enemy, Turnus. He's beaten him, essentially, and Turnus has just gotten done begging for his life. And Aeneas is about to spare him, but then sees the baldric that he's wearing, which is one that Turnus plundered from this dead young man who was entrusted to Aeneas some two or three books earlier. And so Aeneas then, out of rage, as you point out, slaughters Turnus. And so many people would see that as kind of the dark side of Aeneas, as evidence of Virgil's uncertainty or perhaps even dissatisfaction with Aeneas as a, you know, quasi-historical figure. And why that has political implications potentially is that Aeneas is related to Octavian or Augustus, and as well as Julius Caesar. So this argument then runs that if Virgil is criticizing Aeneas, he's in turn criticizing the man who rules all of Rome at this point, that is the prevailing regime. And he's doing it in a very subtle and indirect way.
And we start out with wrath of gods and end up with wrath of an individual.
Yeah.
So there's something of a contrast there. Do you have a sense that the mission is completed for Achilles? I mean, do you have a sense that this is almost finished, or where do you stand with that?
Well, it's a very good question. I think my sense is that he has completed his mission. But I think we're left to wonder if he's gone a little bit further than the mission required, right? Mm-hmm. So the baldric becomes a memorial of his own savage grief, right? It's no longer about Rome. It's no longer about founding the city and by adhering to fate. It's about satisfying his own bloodlust, his own desire for revenge.
So does this start to sound like something that says, you know, axiom that would come much later about absolute power corrupting absolutely? I mean, that once he's in power, he can't control it?
Yeah. It definitely could. One could extend the implications to that degree. And there have been critics who have done that. I don't know if I don't know how I feel exactly about that line of interpretation. Some people see the Aeneid as a powerful, like, anti-war testament.
Well, I was going to say, you can see the cost of war in that, those final lines, and it also seems to contrast with Virgil's love of nature, the countryside, the pastoral, the bucolic. You know, the fields are littered with corpses and blood. Is there some sense of Virgil as almost a prototype of environmentalists or those who really do see the value of the land?
Well, in the Georgics, I suppose.
Yeah, both in the Georgics and in the Eclogues. I mean, in the Georgics in particular, you get this sense of conflict. Once again, on the one hand, agriculture is something that's laudable in the Roman tradition, and agriculture is necessary for humans to live and survive, right? On the other hand, it's figured as an act of war against the earth in the Georgics.
Really?
Yeah, it is. And you're cutting into the earth.
So it's just another conquest, in effect. I mean, it's sort of the analogy that we hear often, you know, conquest of space, conquest of the American West, that kind of thing, conquest of the land.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. And there really hasn't been enough treatment of Virgil as, say, like an environmentalist or I think the time is ripe for kind of like an
eco-interpretation.
Yeah, an eco-centric interpretation of Virgil's works.
So
in general.
The Georgics, were they sort of like how-to, or were they more sheer poetry than that?
A little bit of both. That's been a standard question that people have asked. So the Georgics is the work that is written right before the Aeneid. Its traditional dates are sometime between 41 and 37 – or no, I'm sorry, 37 and 29 B.C. Dryden, the English poet Dryden, famously said that it's the greatest poet – or the greatest poem of the greatest poet or something.
Really?
Yeah.
Dryden
yeah.
really liked the Georgics.
Oh, so. Yeah. And it's complete, first off. So, I mean, if the Aeneid had been – polished to the degree that Virgil wanted, perhaps he would have said, you know, given the Aeneid that status. But basically the Georgics is four books on agriculture, viticulture, animal husbandry, and the raising of bees in particular. Then you have all sorts of other vignettes kind of interspersed. So there's a story of Orpheus, for example, seeking his dead wife in the underworld and so on. It's a very difficult piece of poetry. On the one hand, it does have a fair amount of technical content. On the other hand, basic questions arise as to whether anybody would actually use this work in the course of sowing a field or something like that.
We probably wouldn't be talking about Virgil if he hadn't written the Aeneid. I mean, that's his big claim to fame.
Yes.
Can you say something about his legacy, including the way that he shows up as a character for Dante?
Sure. Okay, so famously, Virgil is the one who guides Dante through the Inferno, through the underworld, right? And the reason that he's the one who gets appointed to do that is that Virgil, in their like late antique period and throughout the medieval period, is credited with being one of the most, if not the most, virtuous pagan. And he gets accredited with this because of the poem that you, Norman, read at the beginning of the segment,
Eclogue 4,
where there's a prophecy of a golden child being born, of a child being born who will bring back a new age of peace and prosperity, a new golden age in general. So later Christians would read this piece of poetry, which is written sometime around 40 BC, as a prophecy of the birth of Jesus Christ. Right. And so in that respect, Virgil becomes Christianized, and that makes him the logical candidate for leading Dante through the Inferno when Dante's writing in the epic tradition himself. So
what about his just general legacy, the importance of Virgil after his death?
Influence on other poets?
Well, sure. I mean, in the Roman tradition, which is what I'm most familiar with, of course, and where I want to go with answering this question. He is the poet that everybody will explicitly acknowledge as being the greatest of the Roman poets. So, for example, the Quintilian, this famous Roman teacher from the first century AD, says that he admits, first off, that Homer is the greatest poet, but that Virgil's just slightly behind him, right? And so on top of that, anybody who writes anything in the form of poetry after Virgil has to deal with like the technical innovations that he brings to the table. And it's pretty clear that all later epic is, if not a reworking of Virgil, seriously depends on Virgil and will oftentimes use various allusions to enrich their own work. So people, in a sense, try to imitate Virgil. And that's a bit reductive, but
inevitably so.
Yeah.
So if there's one thing that we take away from Virgil and the Aeneid in terms of this is really his greatest invention or contribution, what would it be?
I think the Aeneid dramatizes an individual, in this case Aeneas, and his struggle against history and the greater forces that create history, and show the problems that one faces in the course of being a member of a society, in the course of dealing with a traumatic past. So, for example, Aeneas, in many respects, is a veteran of a war that just doesn't end, right? So I think this piece of literature could speak to a lot of contemporary Americans' experiences in that respect.
Thanks for being our guide through the Aeneid and the rest of Virgil.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Grant Nelson-Stewin. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
A hero fall, and Troy once more expire.